Lights. Camera. Action. Now, where's the mullet? Where is he? Is he coming in by chopper again?
And now, live from Quinlan's Cantina in the Gold Coast of Australia, it's time again for your dose of action cinema history from the 80s, 90s, and beyond with the Lethal Mullet Podcast.
Oh, g'day, mate. How you going?
G'day, mate. How you going? This is Adam O'Brien, the Lethal Mullet, here from Quinlan's Cantina in the Gold Coast of Australia for Lethal Mullet Network's signature show, the Lethal Mullet Podcast. How you going out there? Hope you're enjoying the torrential weather we're having here on the Gold Coast of Australia. And tonight we're going to be looking at a classic film, which if you haven't had the chance to see, you definitely need to check out. This is, I personally think, Jet Li's greatest performance. It's his best film, and it's certainly a film where you get to see some really different styles of fighting all within the one film. It's a period film and also an homage to Fist of Fury, otherwise known in other circles of the world as The Chinese Connection, a great Bruce Lee performance and signature of his own as well. Now, this is, of course, a film which really slowed down a lot of the wire work that you saw of Jet Li in previous films, like, of course, the Once Upon a Time in China trilogy, where he played Wong Fei-hung. In this one, he gets to play an amazing role where it's grounded far more in real Western boxing, some very grounded kung fu, but also you definitely see from traditional styles right up to, of course, Bruce Lee's Jeet Kune Do. There's definitely some influence there as well, all in one amazing film, where, of course, in the time period in China's history, they're also up against the Japanese who were occupying parts of China at the time. In this, we have a collision of styles, the karate, and of course other Budo arts of Japan versus the classical Kung Fu and of course Jeet Kune Do. And in this, we have leading the Japanese in this, Yasuaki Karata, or affectionately known as Karata-san. Karata-san does such an amazing job in this as a sensei, or in this, you know, a head of the school who's not only a tough karate fighter, but one that, you know, respectful of not only his own people, but of course of Jet Li's character as well. Respectful of the power and of course the skill and technique of a great fighter. And that's one of the great things that we're going to find on tonight's episode, looking at, of course, the amazing film Fist of Legend. G'day, mate. How you going? Welcome to the Lethal Mullet Network, where you'll find all these amazing shows and more. Where you'll find the Lethal Mullet Podcast, a celebration of action cinema from the 80s, 90s, and beyond. You'll also find Making Treks, a Star Trek fan podcast, where I'm joined by my amazing co-host, Mark Newbold, into a deep dive of Star Trek. You'll also find Mullet and Kilt, a look at music, where I'm joined by my dear pal, Darth Elvis, and where you can also find the Mullet Guild, a look at the Dune universe. All here on, of course, lethalmulletnetwork.podbean.com or on your favourite podcatcher. You can find us there. You can also find all these shows a week later on, of course, the one, the only Fandom Podcast Network, FPN, on fpnet.podbean.com. Don't forget to also follow us on socials. There's, of course, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at the handle at the Lethal Mullet. We'll catch you out there and enjoy your action cinema. And now it's time for the news here on the Lethal Mullet Podcast. Time to chat about the proverbial can of worms that has just opened up. That is, of course, DC have had their fandom. So I've asked a couple of friends, and I've had actually some of the listeners write in and ask what my thoughts are. Now that we've seen a bit more of the Batman trailer with what I've affectionately called Battinson, which I'm sure others have, you know, we've got Batfleck, now we've got Battinson. I'm pretty sure that's what most would say in this case. It is his take on Batman, which looks a little bit rougher. Certainly doesn't look as, I would say, physically threatening. He's not a massive guy, but he's certainly pretty wiry. So it'd be interesting. I'm not going to rule out that this could be a good Batman or a bad Batman, but I will say this, after seeing the full trailer, that the look in this film in particular, I think, is one that's mashing two things. It's mashing Seven with The Dark Knight. You know, it's got that kind of feel, folks. It's quite a dark vision. And Matt Reeves is an amazing director. He did the last two Planet of the Apes films, which are really absolutely gorgeous films. And plot-wise, he really, really is somebody that can string an amazing story together, and one that's always a good hero's journey in whichever way that he's trying to tell the story. And this one looks like it's set about the second year of the Batman's journey. I like that we have Caesar playing Alfred in this, obviously, too. And it looks like it's taking a much more grittier tone. And I don't know how much more gritty you can get than the Nolan trilogy, which is definitely still a benchmark, folks. You know, you can throw all these different new things at it, and even with Batflex run. But let's just say that Pattinson, with his take in this, you know, it looks gritty, it looks tough. You can look at the Batcave, looks like it's in some type of train station or something like that. That's an interesting take in it, something that's been done in the comics previously. You know, and I've got to say, even the Batmobile's looking a hell of a lot like a certain Interceptor from Mad Max, folks. So, yeah, look, it looks good. It looks like it could be decent. I like the idea that they're using the Riddler in this, but, you know, we'll have to wait and see. I have a lot of faith in the director. The cast is interesting. Certainly can't see Colin Farrell under all that penguin makeup. Certainly looks interesting. So anyway, I'll only say this. It looks interesting for me. But I'll tell you, the other one is the other Batman film, which is actually called The Flash. Yes, the return of Michael Keaton's Batman. His Bruce Wayne from the 1989 Tim Burton film, and of course Batman Returns as well. Never came back for the third one. And neither did Tim Burton, obviously, too, folks. And, you know, that is the Batman I grew up with. That is still Batman to me, and he still thinks he is Batman. It looks great. We didn't get to see his face. We certainly got to see the ears, and we got to see the shape of that amazing, you know, Batmobile that we know so well. It's that really amazing, you know, demon. I don't know what other word. I'm a bit tongue-tied to say, but, you know, it's still to this day a dragster with a pulse, you know, a real bat pulse. I still, you know, to this day, he is, to me, the Batman. You can throw him up against all these new ones that agree, but he really is the benchmark, folks, because that film was such a pivotal moment of the late 1980s and leading into the 1990s. What a film. It was the Superman for the time, folks. It really was. But to have the voiceover of Michael Keaton there, that really cemented something for me that, you know, this is where this film's going, folks. And, you know, Ezra Miller's Flash, yes, it's his film, and looks like there's a few Ezra Millers in this, as it's a multi-universe thing, and I'm sure Spider-Man will do the same thing with its one. Look, you know, folks, I'm not that wrapped in comic book culture these days. I'm really enjoying the more reality of martial arts action cinema, and the fact that they are superheroes themselves, but they're more real because everything is done for real. That's right. The stuntmen are the superheroes. But I've got to say that, you know, to have Keaton back is going to be just an amazing thing to see on screen.
Oi, how's your man?
Yeah!
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 Welcome to the dojo. Leave your shoes outside the door.
All right, time for a very, very quick chat here in the dojo, folks. We're going to chat a little bit about different styles, and this was brought up to me in a conversation that I had with a good pal of mine who studies Chinese martial arts, and it's something I've actually dabbled in my 20s after I'd done both karate and aikido. And, you know, going quite senior with both, you know, it got to a stage where with most sports, it's not that you get bored. I think you feel like you're repeating the same steps. And like anything, things get stale in training after a while. You'll want to try something different. And at the time, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon had come out. And I was very, very into the Chinese weapons systems. particularly in the Shaolin system. And, you know, that's literally just from watching the work done by Chow Yun-Fat and, of course, Yuan Wu-Ping and his team on Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Of course, the amazing Michelle Yao as well, who got her work hand-to-hand and then weaponry in that. And, of course, the rest of the amazing cast. It's just, it's mind-boggling, really. And it really comes down to an interesting chat that I had with, you know, my pal who's actually worked on different styles of Chinese martial arts. And, you know, it comes down to, we were chatting about the histories of these, because there's always chats from student to student going, hey, well, my style does this. Well, my style does that. And it becomes a pissing contest without really looking at the histories of where these styles came from. Particularly if you're a karate stylist, then, you know, you should know exactly some of the, you know, it's not just the myth, but the actual history of some of these. And some of these are covered on YouTube videos with Jesse Enkamp and many other martial artists who have actually gone to Okinawa and or wherever. It doesn't matter whether it's karate or another style, and actually looked at the real history of some of these. And it's just as interesting as the stuff that you're taught in the classes. What's great about it is that the chat we had, we talked about where, you know, the lineage of where it's, you know, Goju-Ryu or Shotokan, any of these, you know, classic systems that we, you know, we've all studied over the last couple of decades come from. And of course, you know, the influence comes from China, from Kung Fu, from the unarmed arts, or Kung Fu as some of them call it over there as well. And that was interesting to me, just seeing the differences between that and, of course, how the weapon systems work. For instance, now I've worked in, you know, different weaponry in some of the arts I've done, whether it's in Bujinkan or Aikido. Particularly, let's pick Aikido for example. Aikido uses a staff, and the staff is called the Jo. That's a four-foot staff, the Onshakubo. And with this, that is done a certain way in the Japanese systems. It really uses the entire length of the four-foot staff. That means it's more or less like a needle in some of the moves, you know, really thrusting forward, keeping the range, you know, well at hand and keeping your adversary well away from you, using the entire length of the stick. Yet when you look at some of the stuff in Okinawa and Kabuto and how they use the stick, it's more in line with what you see in, you know, the longbow from, of course, in England, you know, the sort of stuff you'd see, you know, even in Robin Hood films, gives you sort of an indication about how the staff is used over there. So very similar. Yet in some of the Kung Fu systems and what I was learning in my 20s, they were using bamboo as opposed to oak or rosewood or any of those really strong woods. They don't have any given them. And that's the difference between the Japanese staff and, of course, the one in China. China, they use bamboo, and the bamboo itself, of course, has flexibility, and it's part of one of the actual differences I find in some of those, particularly when I was studying Tai Chi. Some of the ways a punch was done in Tai Chi, in the various forms that we were learning, or kata, and of course that was given a certain amount of flexibility, but power and snap at the end, which is something that you learn in karate much later in the belt system, when you become a more senior belt. So one of the great things about that is seeing those sorts of things and influences, and particularly from my mate Jason, who's always had some interesting stuff from when he's gone overseas and vice versa, and just hearing that has always been a great thing. Which brings us to how that relates to this. In Fist of Legend, we do see a collision of styles, but also a meeting of minds. And that's what I love about this film. And I think if you're a martial artist out there tonight listening to the podcast, this is a film you need to see. It's not just because it's a Bruce Lee homage. And it really is. It's one of the better homages to Bruce Lee. See, I think personally better than even the one that was done in the 90s, which was an actual movie on his life, Dragon, the Bruce Lee Story, which is, look, great, fun little movie in its own. But this is really getting to the heart of performance. First of all, giving Jet Li a signature role of Chen Zhen, which we were going to see. And he's taking his own style and melding it with that of Bruce Lee. And Jet Li's his own man. and we're going to see that. But also with Kurata-san, it's a collision of styles and adaptability, and we get to see that in the film. And even some of the other characters that you're going to see in this as we chat about it are going from traditional standpoints of whether it's, an animal style of kung fu versus, the adaptability of boxing. Straight up Western boxing, which is something that just the jab, the thrusting fist coming forward straight and, literally dancing around an opponent, which is yet to see in the film. And Kurata-san's ability with karate as well is just amazing. We've talked about some of his films like Blood Fight earlier in the year. Amazing martial artist and certainly one of the greats from the 70s, which, no doubt you will see. But halfway through the film, after there have been many skirmishes and dojo battles between each, there's a great meeting of minds. And it's obviously something that I personally think is one of the great ones. To have it in a fight film is really, really interesting. And you're about to see why, folks, here as we head into the pub.
Hey, mate, how you going? Come on in, mate. Yeah. What shall it be?
Oh, yeah. Man, it's been real busy day, wow.
Right on, mate.
Hey. Yeah.
It's just like I was telling my mate the other day, have a nice, cold beverage, and enjoy the show, films and all that sort of stuff.
Well, here you go, mate. Here, enjoy this beverage and enjoy this film chat.
It's always something that is hard to do, which is to take something that is beloved, like a film, book, TV show, and to give it a fresh coat of paint. In this case, a reboot. And it's certainly one that makes it even harder when it's a Bruce Lee film. And the most beloved of Bruce Lee films, Fist of Fury. Fist of Fury is without a doubt one of the all-time great, not only action films, martial arts films, but it has a lot to say, and particularly in the political sense and also in the sense of a person's rights and respect and, of course, issues like racism and stuff like that as well. And it's certainly something that, is not only timely no matter where it is in the world and in time itself, but also I think it's something to look back on now and think, we look after the freedoms and stuff like that we have now in society. And back at that time, they weren't in place, particularly for the people involved in this setting and this time. So I think, again, very important film, but a damn great action film and one that showed without a doubt how good Bruce Lee was on screen. He was a renowned martial artist, but he was also just a damn good visual communicator of just how effective martial arts are and how it was visually entertaining. We love seeing people kicked across the screen, thrown, punched, smashed, cut in half, whatever it is. That's something that action fans have always loved. So you fast forward to 1990s, and we've got a new star. Last name's kind of Lee as well, I suppose, L-I, Jet Li. And Jet Li's this character who's, come on the scene with such an amazing talent in Wushu, Wushu champion. His whole power comes from forms, the forms of Wushu, whether it be the weapons or the different animal styles of Kung Fu that are involved in Wushu. But you can see it in everything he does. It's performance-based. And, it's without a doubt some of the greatest out there. It comes after, obviously, we've had Bruce Lee sort of jump on the scene. After Bruce Lee, we've had Jackie Chan, Sammo Hung, Yuen Biao, and all these other talents that have kind of all had their own voice, their own style. Jet Li's, he's totally got his own style, always has. But, of course, he was involved in so many period films as well. Of course, we've talked about the Wong Fei-Hung films, which, folks, yes, in a couple of weeks, I'm going to look at the trilogy. I'm not going to break them down into each episode, but we'll break it down into the trilogy itself. And, of course, it went off into sequels after the trilogy as well. But 1, 2, and 3, Wong Fei-Hung, known affectionately out here as Once Upon a Time in China, 1, 2, and 3 are just absolutely gorgeous films. And, of course, it was the first film which Jet Li did against Donnie Yen. And it's funny that Donnie would come back years later, with Yuen Wu Ping, and did Iron Monkey. You know, and the great thing about Iron Monkey is that he's playing Wong Kei Ying, the father of Wong Fei Hung. And you get to see, it's a prequel. You get to see the legendary martial artist Wong Fei Hung in that setting. So, again, amazing and everything you'd expect in a martial arts film. But I digress. We're going to be talking about tonight is Fist of Legend from 1994, directed by Gordon Chan. And the choreography, as we mentioned earlier, Wu Ping is in, the maestro behind, without a doubt. Now, the film came out in late 94, in December, it's before Christmas. And, of course, 1972, we had the original version of this story, the kernel of this whole legend. And, of course, which starred Bruce Lee, set in the Shanghai International Settlement of 1937. Now, this was around about the beginning of when World War II was kicking off, and the Imperial Japanese Army had been in and around the area. There was encampments at Shanghai, and it's just without a doubt, particularly this film, it sets the pace of just what life would have been like for the Chinese in that area at the time, particularly, people studying and stuff like that as well. And we have the character Chen Zhan, which we're going to meet in this. It's a fictional character. It came together, obviously, in the first film. It was created by a Hong Kong writer by the name of Ni Kuang, who, had this idea of sort of putting all of that together into a role of this person that would sort of act as not only somebody looking for the truth of the matters when it came to the murder of his own master, and of course, legendary martial arts master, Huo Yanjia. Now, Huo Yanjia is also a role that Jet Li played in the film Fearless, which was at the time, I think, believed to be the last film that Jet Li was going to do as a period martial arts action drama, whatever you want to call it. He's since done countless martial arts films. You know, Jackie Chan's made the same claim and said, this will be the last martial arts film that I do. I think technically they have moved on to more straight-ahead action fare since. But let's, first of all, before we get into the story, have a look at what really started this myth here and what it's all about. The big thing about this is that it all starts with Chen Zhan is centered in basically a Kyoto University where local hoods from what they call the Black Dragon Clan, which was basically a ultra-nationalist group in Japan. They were paramilitary, prominent at the time, and really nothing but trouble. Now, you may know the Black Dragon Society from other areas and other films. In Bloodsport, they're known as the Kokorukai, which is the Japanese term for it, based on where they are in the Amu River. So Kokorukai is what they say is putting on the Bloodsport, the Kumite, if you like, in that film. So, again, an organization which goes hand-in-hand with crime, and particularly in this one too, and just bad deeds. So that's pretty much where you're getting a lot of, particularly the racist part of this, particularly where the Japanese see themselves in this this setting as superior to the Chinese, which they're occupying their country of. So Chen Zhan, he's a character who basically comes into the film to find that he goes back to his martial arts school and finds that his master, Huo Yanjia, has died when he's gone against a Japanese karate master by the name of Akutagawa Ryuchi. And Chen is obviously, absolutely a mess when it comes to finding out that his master has passed away. and leaves immediately from Kyoto to go back to Shanghai. So he's been traveling from abroad and goes back. And actually, you can see that fight in Fearless at the end. You can see Ryuichi go against Huo Yanjia. And the idea is that Chen finds out that Yanjia was actually poisoned. He's basically given something before he went into that fight, which weakened him because he was a far better fighter than the Japanese fighter. And again, you know, it sort of worked out that way. But before we see all this, Chen is in the university in Kyoto, and he's romantically involved in a relationship with a Japanese girl by the name Mitsuko. And Mitsuko is being bullied around by the thugs from the Black Dragon Clan. And some of these are part of a karate school. And basically, they pick on straight away the character of Chen Zhen. And, of course, violence ensues. Quite a good scene where we get to see Jet Li go to town in a schoolroom, just kicking the living crap out of everybody. And, of course, he applies not only straight-up kicks, punches, etc., but he's doing it with a lot of restraint, and he's using in this Chin Na techniques, which is, you know, if you look in the Budo schools, it's probably closer to Aikido and Jiu-Jitsu. There's joint locks and different thrusts and stuff like that to put down people without using too much force and controlling them. And he does it quite well. But at the same time, Mitsuko gets a broken pen. And this is where we see a great actor come into the scene playing the sensei, and that is, of course, Funakoshi Fumio. So Funakoshi comes in and played by, of course, the amazing Kurata-san, which we talked about before, Yasuki Kurata. And when Yasuki Kurata comes in, not only does he feel embarrassed that his students have done this, you know, there's a real sense of, oh, God, they've done it again. So they've probably done this a few times where they've thrown their weight around, and the sensei's got a far more, you know, moral approach to the things and balance in terms of how he respects people. You know, he really has respect for all, and particularly with the skill of Chen, you know, he could see it. He sees martial skill completely. And, of course, Chen comes from a school called the Jingwu School, which was a legit school in China. And it was founded in Shanghai in 1910, and could be even earlier. And it's spelled different ways. You can it's Jingwu, Jingmou, 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 depending on how it's said. But the school itself, being a legit martial arts academy, obviously, is one that we see in both versions of the film, where we see traditional martial arts, in the case of traditional kung fu, being taught, etc. there too. So Chen, after this, returns to Shanghai, and at this stage, he goes back to the Jingwu School, and he meets Huo Tingyan. And Huo Tingyan is the son of Huo Yanjia. Huo Yanjia is basically becoming the brand new master of Jingwu after his father's passing. And from there, Chen's still fuming by this. You know, he's the great thing about the way, particularly about the way Jet Li plays it, Bruce plays it pretty on the nose, like that it's you know, a character that's dealing with grief and that's rough. Jet kind of leaves it under the surface a little bit. He's fuming, but he's in control. And I think that's the difference between the two versions of it. So Chen goes to the Japanese dojo to challenge Akutagawa, and who says, yeah, okay, I'll fight you. And not only does he defeat Akutagawa easily, he humiliates the entire dojo. And, of course, this is just like the version in Fist of Fury. But the scenes you see in this of Jet Li going against it, there's techniques of very similar to some very, very invasive Aikido throwing, some great groundwork. There's also some really just great punching, roundhouses, kicks, cartwheel kicks. A lot of it, again, grounded. There's not much wire work in this film, if any, at all. And I think that's what makes it so appealing to, you know, martial artists like myself who we want to see a little bit more real sometimes. So after this, we obviously see that the fact that there's been some type of murder going on when it comes to Kuo Yan Jia. So we get Chen Zhen and sort of more of a Sherlock Holmes kind of part where he's literally going around trying to find the people responsible for killing his master, Kuo Yan Jia. This is where both films excel quite well. And obviously this leads to violence, vengeance, and, you know, I think particularly in the Bruce Lee version, we get to see Chen dealing with not only the run-of-the-mill, the dojo stuff. Obviously, you know, there's the animosity between the two dojos. Obviously, the Japanese dojo and obviously the Jingwu Fight Academy. With the Jingwu school, you know, they're not only pressed upon with that, but they're also pressed upon where they've got the very, very, you know, racist tones that the Japanese school's taking against the Jingwu, calling them inferior and all that sort of stuff. And I think that's the thing, again, spurs on the character of Chen to not only fight them, but just not take any crap whatsoever. And he really does, again, the strength of both films, and particularly Fists of Legend, where we get to see, you know, people like Akuta Gawa, who's got this, you know, massive amount of, you know, karate students there. He's getting thrown all over the place. And, of course, himself get pretty much humiliated. And each fight, particularly in this film, you get to see the way Wu Ping's designed them. He's designed in such a way that, you know, the character is so clever. Jet Li is basically in each fight citing just exactly how these opponents that he's up against use their, whether it's their height, their range, their length of their arms in terms of attack. And he really does invade that space, particularly in the fight with Akuta Gawa. And he doesn't know how to handle it because he's used to kicking or punching or using his bigger frame, and that's what's interesting. So from here, Akuta Gawa, after being humiliated, goes up and he has to see General Go Fujita, who's the head of the Imperial Army there, and he basically suspects that, hey, look, was my, you know, fight against Kuo Yan Jia completely rigged? You know, was this fight, you know, taken out of context to the point where they made it easy for him to take on it without even saying anything? Fujita wipes him out, takes him out of the equation. And of course, once they see this, the students think that, you know, the basically Chen and the Jingwu school have killed their master. So then we have a big fight where we see basically Jingwu versus the Japanese dojo. And again, a lot of this is, you know, done, I think, better in the original version. With this too, you got Chen being hunted by the police, and you know, again, they can't have enough, you know, evidence to put it down that it's Chen doing all these, you know, bashings and killings and stuff like that on the side. So a lot of that sort of interesting how that sort of plays out. But what ends up happening is Chen, once he finds out who's really behind things, of course, the general, Fujita, it basically gets him to get his power together after basically taking Mitsuko out to the family's gravesite and out to Kuo Yan Jia's grave. He meets the Japanese sensei that he met in Japan, Funakoshi, and he's brought in by Fujita to take out Chen. And Funakoshi and Chen fight, a real fight. It's a beautiful fight. It's out in this sort of grass paddock out near the graves. And by the end, not only do they
you have a meeting of the minds. And this is what I love about it, folks, is that that fight shows you the strength of both styles, but also shows the kernel of the truth that, you know, the karate has a root in kung fu. So again, they're one and the same. They're striking arts, which basically one influenced the other, but they're also the same at the same time. And again, it's also showing the superiority of being wise and not being just young, because the way that obviously we get to see Funakoshi fight, you know, he's smart about it. Even the way that he sets up the fight is kind of a little bit like Musashi did as a swordsman, where he would always turn up late, always delay fights for, you know, just to annoy the other swordsman or the other fighter. And, you know, sometimes it paid off, sometimes it didn't. And that is really, really well done. So we get to see that. We get to see also a great fight when he gets back from that fight and he's goes back to the Jing Wu school. Kuo Ting En has had enough of Chen's, you know, basically his baloney. And says, you and I are going to have this out. Who's going to actually lead the Jing Wu school? And, of course, Chen doesn't really care. The only thing he cares about is his relationship with Mitsuko. So when Mitsuko-san comes back to the Jing Wu school, they don't want anything to do with it. So it's kind of the animosity between the Chinese and the Japanese at that point fires up the school for a fight between Jet Li, because he's trying to protect Mitsuko-san, against obviously, you know, the rivals, and this time being his own friends. And of course, now the leader of the school, Kuo Ting En. So Kuo Ting En, from here, fights a very traditional fight of Jing Wu against Jet Li. And Jet Li starts out with a very, very classical style. So he's basically doing his Jing Wu style. But from there, halfway through it, being somebody who's traveled a bit, seen some other fighting in terms of Western boxing, he starts to do Muhammad Ali style southpaw and right cross work. And the way he does it, his footwork's jumping and he's bouncing around him with that swagger of a great boxer. Again, this is some of the great stuff that we get to see from the Jeet Kune Do influence into this. You know, using no style with what did he say? He said, using no limitation as limitation and using no way as way, whatever it was. But basically is find something that works for you and use it. and again, you know, it's great, but in what you get to see in the original version, Bruce Lee does all that. And then at the end, his character, Chen Zhen, faces a firing squad. Basically, he just jumps out. Simple as that. But after Fujita dies in this one, Chen basically accepts that he's killed Fujita in order to prevent you know, further bloodshed. And from them, instead of Chen getting killed, the ambassador then stages a fake execution. So this is what's interesting. It's a different idea, but Chen is actually then taken from Shanghai and sent to Manchuria. So again, interesting idea. They twisted it around. Without a doubt, one of the better plots too for a Jet Li film. So let's have a look at it. So Mandarin, the film is called Jing Wu Ying Xiong. Cantonese, Xing Mao Jing Hong. Obviously written by, as we mentioned also, the director Gordon Chan and Lam Ki To and Kim Yip. Produced by Jet Li. This is a time where Jet Li really started to kick off some amazing films. He'd done that work in the Shaolin films that he did, the Shaolin monk films, early, I think it was mid-80s he did. In this we also have Chin Siu Ho, Shunobu Nakayama, Billy Chow, Yasuaki Kurata, Paul Chun. Has great music by Joseph Koo and Stephen Edwards. The production company behind this was Eastern Productions and, of course, distributed by the always reliable Golden Harvest. So, with that, we're going to move into chatting about the cast and just some of the great characters that this cast plays. So let's have a look. So first up, we have Jet Li as Chen Zhen. Now, let's have a look at the character of Chen Zhen as well, and a little bit. Now, the great thing about this character of Chen Zhen is that Donnie Yen has played this role as well. So again, interesting idea. Now, he's an apprentice of the martial artist Huai Yunjia, founder of the Chin Wu Athletic Association, also known as the Chin Wu School or Jing Wu in 1910. Their rivals were, of course, the Japanese dojo in the Hongku district of Shanghai. And one of the things that they talk about with Huai Yunjia is that there was a certain sense of spirit that he had with, you know, that style as well. So there's actually a lot more actors that have played the role of Chen Zhen. We have Bruce Lee, Bruce Leung, back in 1982, 81, and 2001. Jet Li, obviously, Donnie Yen, Jordan Chan as well. There's a couple others too. So very, very interested. The martial artist that this stylist in obviously is a fictional stylist, but the ones that they've used in is Hong Fist, Karate, Mizong Fist, and Nunchuku. That's right. So Bruce Lee's character using that. You don't really see that in Fist of Legend. Fist of Legend he uses a belt, but more as a restraint weapon and a whipping style weapon. So it's interesting. Never seen him use nunchaku, I don't think, in any of the films that he's done. So, interesting. Now, a little bit of trivia here I found too is Legend of the Fist, The Return of Chen Zhen is one that starred Donnie Yen. And interesting that he says, the difference between his Chen Zhen and early versions, he says Chen Zhen is Bruce Lee. So that, you know, that's basically what it is. And that serves as the idea of just everything when it comes down to it. Obviously, the white suit, the use of the nunchaku, you know, that whole idea, you know, everything. The big dojo fights, everything. It's just huge. Which is, I think, you know, one of the great parts of just what this whole thing's about. So we have Chin Siu Ho playing Huo Teng Yin. Huo Teng Yen, sorry. And I've seen him in quite a bit of work over the years. He's somebody that particularly holds quite a bit of, natural leadership in the way that he's playing some of these roles. And, of course, that's just part of being a great actor. You know, he's able to really show that, you know, it looks like he's in charge of this area. So he's a martial artist also. And he was also in Tai Chi Master with Jet Li, which is another film too. But I think he does really, really a good job as playing the young master who's taking over the school of Jing Wu getting back to everything there too. Karate-san, what can we say about Karate-san that we haven't already said? He's an amazing martial artist who's got high dan ranks in karate, judo, and aikido. And it really shows, you know, like he's always had that, you know, ability to be involved in great martial arts and stuff like that too. So he's got a 7th degree in karate, 3rd degree in judo, and 2nd dan in aikido. Now, he actually operates his own action club, if you like. So it's where people can learn to do stunts, martial arts, and all that sort of stuff, action for film. And you get to see this if you get the Dragon Dynasty version of the film, where you get to see a reporter goes to the location of his action club, and they take him through various different action beats and stuff like that and how to do an actual action scene. Crazy, but it's amazing. Now, the reason that he gets so much work is that he's fluent in Cantonese and has done work in both Japan, mainland China, and Hong Kong. And he's actually got dojos in Tokyo, Osaka, and Hong Kong. So, you know, you just see his works speaks for itself. He's got so much there. Titles like The Godfather Squad, The Executioner, Fatal Strike, Gold Snatchers, Black Panther, A Girl Called Tigress, One by One. I mean, these are great films. And he's still going. It's just, there's still a lot of films coming out over the next couple of years too. Running through a 10 to Royal Swordsman that he's doing now. Fist of Hero, or also known as Hero of Shanghai, which he did back in 99 by the look of it too. So, and look, again, just a lot of different stuff, a lot of TV shows these days. Great martial artist and one you got to check out. We've got Shinobu Nakayama, who plays Mitsuko in this, and she's great. She kind of steals a lot of the scenes really, really well because she's playing that sort of innocent but also quite rebellious teenager, you know, student who's trying to still have the affections of course, of the great, you know, crowd that they've got there in terms of martial artists and stuff like that. Billy Chow, or Bi Lei, is a Hong Kong Canadian martial artist. He's also a retired kickboxer. He's great in this. He's a fairly small role, but well known to obviously huge crowds. He's the WKA World Welterweight Champion from back in 84 to 86. It's great. He's from Alberta, Calgary, Canada. His kickboxing record is total wins 53, wins 45, 32 of those by knockout, which is just great. He trains fighters now out of Billy's Gym in Hong Kong and Frank Lee's Muay Thai in Canada. He retired from acting at the age of 48 after his last film, Dragon in Fury. So some of the big ones you can see him in is Dr. Y in The Script with No Swords in 96, Tai Chi Boxer with Jackie Wu, Iron Monkey 2 with Donnie Yen, which I've been told has nothing to do with the original Iron Monkey, so there you go, folks. He played an elite soldier in Eastern Condors with, of course, Sammo Hung, Yun Biao, and Yun Wu Ping, putting all that together, and, of course, Dragons Forever and Miracles he was in as well. He's a very, very accomplished kickboxer who should be used in a lot more. I think he just does a fantastic job. He's also in Future Cops, Once Upon a Time in China 4 as well. Just brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. So, again, something worth checking out, folks, is the work that he's done in those too. So, you know, just brilliant. Now, let's look at the influence on this film. You know, this is one that, without a doubt, has put Jet Li on the mark, you know. Now, from this, seeing the work that Jet Li did, this is where he started getting a lot of the films that you would see later, films like Kiss of the Dragon, you know, and there's, of course, you know, it influenced Fists of Legend, influenced a lot of the films later, mainly due to, you know, the realism of what it was, you know, no wire gags and, you know, keeping things as grounded as they can too. Because you look back on it, you look at things like particularly Jet Li's film, Romeo Must Die, maybe even what else did he do? It was about that time. The One, there was just so many wire gags put in there. And it's interesting how that sort of everyone particularly Tom went, Fist of Legend is great because that looks real. It looks like you're actually doing that. And it came back. And, of course, you know, after that, Wu Ping was hired for The Matrix because of those sorts of styles. They wanted to get back to that feel, you know. That's crazy but true. 2006, as we mentioned, Huo Yanjia was played by Jet Li in Fearless. So it's kind of like, I guess, a bit of a prequel to it too. And, of course, we got the continuation in Legend of the Fist with Donnie Yen playing Chen Zhen in his 30s. So it really comes back to. But, folks, this is an amazing film. The martial arts feel real in it. You know, it's got an amazing, you know, run when it comes to, you know, it's fast. Fast-paced in particular, the way it's edited. I think that's what you're going to like about it too. There's multiple different versions of this. It came out in DVD in, with Ritech and back in 97, made out in Taiwan, and basically put out as an uncut version. Miramax put it out DVD in the US with a English dub and some slightly different elements to the score. HK Video brought out a version as well, Maxam did. But the one I've got here is the Dragon Dynasty version. Now, this was put out by that label in America. It has heaps of extras. It's a two-disc. It was released in Australia in Region 4. It says single disc. Well, folks, I'm opening up now, and it's not single. It's two-disc. So this may well be the, international version, I would say. There's also many different special features on there. There's The Man Behind the Legend, exclusive interview with Gordon Chan. Brothers in Arms, exclusive interview with Chin Siu Ho. Way of the Warrior, an exclusive interview with Kurata-san, which is actually quite a good interview. The School of Hard Knocks, screen fighting seminar at the Karate Action School. You also get a look at Fist of Legend director Brett Ratner and his thoughts on it, deleted scenes, and a trailer gallery. As the blurb at the top says, this is Jet Li's best work. And it really is, folks. This is a film that's unparalleled when it comes to martial arts potential and more. Here on the Lethal Mullet podcast, it gets a stellar 5 out of 5 on the Hallenbach scale. G'day, folks. Hope you're enjoying the great shows here on the Phantom Podcast Network. Be sure to check out all the great shows that we have on offer and subscribe on the master feed at fpnet.podbean.com. You can check Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast hosted by Kevin the Raider Nerd Rysel and Lee Fillingsus on their platform. You can also check out Culture Clash, which is the weekly look at pop culture hosted by Kevin and Kyle. Couch Potato Theatre, this is a cult classics and guilty pleasure podcast. Also Time Warp, a fandom flashback show. End Zone, a look at the NFL, the American football. Also Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast, looking at the great films of Alfred Hitchcock. Union Federation podcast, a Star Trek and Orville podcast, looking at Discovery and, of course, Picard, plus the Orville. Also, the Hair Metal podcast, looking at the great shows put on by the amazing bands back in the late 80s, their discs, their LPs, everything, all covering the fashion as well, hosted by Kevin the Raider Nerd Reitzel. You can also check out Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, hosted by Kevin and Dan Hadley, looking at all the eras of Doctor Who. You can also catch out What a Piece of Junk, a Star Wars podcast, an amazing show looking at Star Wars, hosted by Derek and Scott. And of course, our newest one, the amazing, The Mullet Guild, an offshoot of the Lethal Mullet podcast looking at Frank Herbert's Dune universe. This is like an encyclopedia for Dune, where I take you through and down into the rabbit hole of Frank Herbert's amazing space opera, the sprawling universe which is going to be brought to life by Denis Villeneuve and December 18. You can check out all the shows there. Be sure to also go onto the social platforms on Twitter at FanPod Network. Let us know what you think of the shows and what else you can look at there. You can also check out great articles that we put up through there that we share. Also check out on Instagram and Facebook, Phantom Podcast Network. Be sure to make sure that every Tuesday you check out the great work done by Making Treks as well. A brand new podcast looking at a deep dive of Star Trek, hosted by myself, James Semple, and of course, the ever popular and amazing writer of Star Trek and Star Wars, Mark Newbold. Go and check it out, folks, and we'll catch you next time here on the Phantom Podcast Network's The Lethal Mullet Podcast. Good afternoon, good evening, and good night.